This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Ralph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Project, welcome back to this exciting episode. We have on a returning guest today. We have on Mr. Matt Fitzgerald, he's an author, but he's also an incredible runner, and I'd say he's almost a bit of a friend these days. And you know, if we've interviewed him before about his book, How Bad Do You Want It? It is an amazing book where he ties together exercise science and research and sports psychology research with stories of incredible athletic feats to help us understand more about mental fitness and the mind. This episode, we talked about his two books, Running the Dream, where he enters as a kind of mature age athlete in his 40s into a pro running camp. So with some young guns that are, you know, Olympic potentials and, you know, obviously just full-time athletes. So he entered into that camp to train for a marathon. So we talk about all the stories, all the lessons that he learned from training with professional athletes there, which is, you know, super cool. And obviously it was called it Running the Dream because it is, I think, a dream of anyone to be able to train with pros and live the life of a pro athlete when you obviously never made it yourself. And then we do talk about as well with running having gotten so popular during lockdown for so many people, kind of the biggest mistakes that most people make when running and trying to get better at running from just an amateur level. And it's called, from his book, The 80-20 of Running, or 80-20 Running, something like that. And obviously, Matt's authored a lot of books, but we did focus on these two specifically. So some really great stories, obviously, from the first part, Running the Dream, and then 80-20, some really cool lessons about how to get better at running, just some really simple stuff that most people get wrong. So we're super pumped to get into that. I don't even know our sponsors.
And Activated Nutrients.
Okay. So one of the issues that most of us end up facing these days, we don't really know what's going on inside of our body. We have some intuition after training, but I'll tell you what, 10 years into training my body and there's still days where I think I'm going to absolutely smash it and I'm wrong. And then there's other days where I feel like absolute garbage and I end up doing really well. And you know, that's great when that happens, but I think it's nice to have more control over, okay, how ready am I to train today? How hard should I push today? If I push too hard today, am I going to compromise the rest of the week? Am I going to compromise my program? And how well am I sleeping? You know, some days you wake up, you felt like you had a really awesome sleep, but then you end up crashing at 2 o'clock, you know, because you just maybe timed the sleep cycle right, but you know, you actually didn't sleep well at all. And then we just want to learn more insights about our body. If I hydrate with this much, or if I, you know, drink alcohol, if I eat these foods, how is this affecting my sleep? How is this affecting my recovery? There's all these unknown questions, and we're very fortunate in 2020, a company like Whoop is allowing us deeper and deeper insights into the answers of these questions. So if you guys want to kind of take your training to the next level, if you really want to get better at improving, you know, just learning more about you. And I think, you know, I'll speak for myself here, I've learned more really about my sleep than anything else.
And just learning, you know, the biggest part for me is just learning which days to train hard and which days to back it off. And having a visual marker, say, okay, today all you need to do is hydrate and sleep a little bit extra.
Totally.
Because you're 15%.
Yeah, totally. And there's such valuable insights. So, and it's obviously super fashionable. These bands look amazing now. The technology is awesome. You guys can pick up your Whoop strap, join the Whoop 3.0, join the Muscle Project team as well. We've got a big leaderboard there, all the Whoop users that listen to the podcast. When you go to whoop.com, and then guys, you can use the code MINDMUSCLE, okay, when you check out, MINDMUSCLE, one word, and you can get 15% off anything when you use that code. As well, one of the other problems I think we face in modern life is obviously we know we need a ton of vitamins and minerals to be healthy, but we just don't have the time to get them in. We don't have the time to eat, you know, all the varieties of vegetables and fruits and drinks and, you know, all the different meats and, you know, just thinking about it, talking about it right now, it's like, man, I miss this stuff all the time. We have the best intentions. We know what to do, but we just don't have the time to do it. Thank God for Activated Nutrients. It gives us the opportunity to get all those in and much better than we used to. The technology and the ingredients in this particular product, in the Top Up, which is their flagship product, is much better than most other companies. And the reason that is because they use whole food, not synthetic vitamins. And whole food vitamins, it's a more expensive process, which is why most companies avoid it, but it means better absorption into your system. And that's ultimately what you want. You don't want to take a multivitamin or a greens powder and just piss the whole thing out. But when you take Activated Nutrients Top Up for men and Top Up for women, or Top Up for kids, Top Up for masters, whatever product is suited for you, you're going to absorb much more of those vitamins. You've got digestive enzymes in there. You've got pre-probiotics. You've got, you know, vitamin D. That's a huge thing that we've been talking about kind of during the pandemic and stuff. So you've got it all in there. It's one teaspoon a day. It's less, it costs less than a serving of coffee. There's no excuse not to have it. If you guys go to activatednutrients.com, you buy any of these products, you use the code OFFERMMP. That's one word, OFFERMMP. You're going to get 20% off your entire order. Guys, we're very excited for this episode again with Matt. Here we go. All right, My Muscle Project, welcome back. We have one of our favorite guests, personal favorite guests of all time, and that's because when we first read Matt's book in 2017,
yes,
we read How Bad Do You Want It's Made a Profound Impact on the Way We Viewed Mental Fitness and Mental Strength. And Matt, we're very excited to have you back on the show today, so thank you so much for being on.
I'm excited to be back. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. And today we want to talk a lot about this new book where you kind of mention you, at your age, joined one of the most elite running squads in the world, half your age, and talk through some of those experiences, and then really get into, because running has become so popular with the lockdown, what I think a lot of people have kind of
gone, Strava is like number one on the App Store here.
Yeah, it's going crazy. I think people want to know, how can they improve their running? And there's a lot of... You have a lot of amazing information on that. So, yeah, let's start with this, you know, this book where you decided to go out and what gave you the impetus or the idea that you would go and do this, you know, quite adventurous feat for your age?
Yeah, you know, I think anyone who develops a passion for a sport has that fantasy experience of, you know, what if I could go pro? You know, what if I could just take this all the way, find out how good I could be if, you know, I didn't have a job and family responsibilities, you know, and I had, you know, all the coaches and equipment and support I needed, free shoes, all that. And, you know, I started running when I was very young and, I was pretty good at it, but it was clear that I wasn't going to ever run professionally. I wasn't going to the Olympics. I knew where I stood, but still I had that, I fully intended to keep running and to just see how good I could be because I loved it. and I got away from running for a while, got back into it. And I became very injury prone. So I just and then I got old. and so before I knew it, you know, there's this dreaded phenomenon of the last PB in running. It's like when you don't realize it when it's happening, but only in retrospect, you look back and you're like, dang, I'm actually never going to run faster again. Yeah. Yeah. And for me, it was actually kind of like a bona fide midlife crisis. But then weirdly, when I was 45-ish, I just got into a groove. I guess maybe figured some things out, had a little stretch of health, and my running improved. And I got a little bit of momentum going. And so it just energized me, and I thought, just the idea popped into my head, you know, why don't I live out this fantasy that I know is very, you know, it's widely held, not just among runners, but in other sports too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that very few people would ever have the opportunity to do. And if I didn't write, I would never have done it. It would just have been, you know, completely selfish exercise. But I felt that if I did it, had this experience and wrote about it, that everyone else who would love to do it but can't could live the experience through me. And that's what happened.
Yeah, I think that's definitely how it reads and how it's played out. So yeah, walk us through some of those experiences from the book. How do you kind of set up the initial deal, and who were the people involved, and why did you choose them in particular?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of professional running enclaves scattered throughout the U.S., and I have, loose connections just because of the work I do with a few. Northern Arizona Elite in Flagstaff, Arizona was my first choice because they have a reputation for being very open and transparent. And it's just part of their mission is to share their journey with the broader running community. So I thought, you know, I was just looking, you know, it seems kind of like a half-baked scheme. I mean, someone knocks on the door and says, hey, I'm old and slow. Can I join your professional running team? So I wanted to approach someone I might get a yes from. And Ben Rosario, who's the head coach and founder of NAZ Elite, I thought, you know, I had a decent chance that there was a decent chance that he would get it, you know, that he would see, not just do it for my sake, but see what was in it for the team. I was hoping that he would see it as fitting in with his mission, just another vehicle for connecting with the community. And yeah, he did say yes. It was actually really easy, to get the opportunity. And then the rest was just setting it up, you know, because I wasn't just doing it as a runner. I was doing it as a writer as well. So I had to sort of wear both hats, and, you know, decided like appropriate time. Summer seemed to make sense. Appropriate duration. I needed to be there for a full training cycle, also long enough to build relationships with everyone there. And then, of course, I had to culminate in some kind of, you know, everyone's seen the classic sports movies, like it has to end in the big game, right? And yeah. So I needed a big game at the end. And for me, that ended up being the Chicago Marathon. I wanted to do a race that at least one real member of NAZ Elite was also doing, just because it would make the whole thing integrated. And that's how it came together.
Mm. And what about the experience initially, like say in the first month or so? What from your expectations was different? I mean, obviously people going into these elite camps, there's always a story you tell yourself or an idea or a vibe of how the culture is or whatever. What shocked you initially when you were first there in that first month?
I got a shock, forgive me if you think in meters, it's 7,000 feet of altitude. And, you know, I live pretty much at sea level. So what is that, 2,300 meters or something? It's thin air. And so I had never trained at high altitude before. And I remember that I described this in the book, my first full day in Flagstaff. So I lived with one of the members of the team, Matt Yano, and he had a dog. And my wife came with me. And we have a dog, and we went to take our dog for its first walk, and I let Matt Yano's dog escape, and it's a fast young dog, and I had to sprint after it. I hadn't even run in Flagstaff yet, so this was my first run. It's trying to catch this animal before it got hit by a car. I mean, talk about getting off on the wrong foot with your host.
Yeah.
And I just remember it just about killed me. I'm like, what's going on? I felt like I was breathing through a straw and like I was getting lightheaded chasing this animal. And then I realized how high up I was. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh dear, what have I gotten myself into? And then my first real, I started with a couple of very easy runs, but my first real run that was challenging at all, I had a similar experience where I was just dying out there. So right from the get-go, there were lots of things like that, where there was just an adjustment. I had to, you know, adopt a whole new lifestyle. It wasn't my kitchen, and my wife does most of the cooking at home, and she didn't really want to cook in a stranger's kitchen. So it's like, okay, now what? What do I eat? I was busier than I expected to be. Just stuff like the rehab, like they call them corrective exercise routines or whatever. I was just trying to copy everything that the real pros did. And my host, it was nice being with a member of the team versus like renting an apartment somewhere, because I could really see what the lifestyle was. And he was always doing something to help his running. Even relaxing was, he would have compression boots on his legs or something, or he would take a nap in the afternoon. Like, that sounds like, you know, the easy life, but like he had to do it. Like it was part of the job. So I was very surprised by just how jam-packed the days were. You know, I thought they were things would slow down, and they did in a way, but I was just busy in a different way there.
Mm. And how did you find your body obviously responding to the increased volume and intensity and that sort of thing? Was it responding how you expected, or was it, you know, much more difficult than you thought?
Yeah, you know, after those initial shocks, you know, everything was hard initially, because, you know, I'm one of the few runners who takes strength training seriously. So I felt like, well, okay, that's a checked box. And then, I went to my first coached team strength workout. And, I never heard of any of the exercises I was asked to do. You know how it is. Like, you get into a rut where you're kind of doing the same thing over and over. And you're only good at what you always do. So I just made a fool out of myself in my first strength workout when I thought I was just going to be the strongest guy in the gym. The first time I did like drills, like form drills, same deal. Like I was just, stumbling all over the place. So I went through a lot of, it was almost like a hazing process early on. Like the altitude was too much for me. But when I came out the other side of that, I started to feel good. And I started to, I lost weight. I lost 5 pounds maybe in the first couple of weeks there. Now we got to do kilos here, like 2 kilos, whatever.
Yeah. And you guys don't have much to lose, like pretty lean going.
Yeah, I was a skinny dude. I thought, I already thought I was at my racing weight when I showed up there. I ended up losing 9 pounds.
Wow.
13 weeks. Yeah. Oh, I was a rail by the end of it. Yeah. But, whatever. Because Coach Ben, the coach of the team, he wasn't used to coaching athletes as slow as I am. Is not that I'm that slow, but I mean, compared to these people trying to get to the Olympics, I was, and I was a lot older. And so he would, give me target times, and I started blowing them out of the water early on. And, I was losing weight, and I was just, because I was getting like a good quality sports massage every single week. I'm seeing their physiotherapist, like doing all the stuff he's telling me to do. And when you piece all that together, sleeping really well, eating really well. And I was working really hard, but I didn't feel it. Most of the running was on trails. There are no trails where I live. So even, tiny little stuff like that, you piece it all together. And I just felt great almost all the time. I had very, very few bad runs. I was constantly on the brink of getting injured, because that's me. But other than like the real trouble spots, generally getting out of bed in the morning was like not nearly as hard as when I'm, in heavy training on my own. I almost just felt like I was becoming more athletic, kind of aging in reverse in a way. And that was a big surprise, because I thought I was just going to be barely surviving the whole way through. And that's not really the experience I had.
So I just want to touch on the injury thing you just mentioned. Obviously you're just on the brink of injury all the time. Obviously guys would have gotten injured as well, or had niggles or whatever. How did they deal with that? Because obviously in professional sports, it's like you've got this huge mission, this huge goal, and it almost feels like I don't really have time to be injured, so I'll just work through it. But then obviously there's other camps that are like, no, we stop everything, we heal the injury, then we rehab. What was their protocol and approach to niggles and injuries?
Yeah. I mean, it's, running is just, it's hard on the body. It's not like rugby or contact sports where you have a lot of acute injuries. They're, the slow onset overuse types of things, but they're, compared to even, non-impact endurance sports like swimming and cycling, the injury rates in running are very high. So it's just so normal. Everyone gets their turn in the barrel. and so they just, they have a system. And when I suffered one significant injury while I was out there, and I was in the physiotherapist's office within 2 hours of suffering the injury. I didn't have to make an appointment. Like, he was their guy. And so it was just so difference making, just to have those resources. Also, to be coached, normally I'm self-coached. I am a coach, so I feel competent to coach myself, but definitely, we're all a little more rational when we're telling someone else to take it easy versus ourselves. So I remember, I had a little bit of an Achilles problem early on, and, Coach Ben just told me to take a day off, and normally I would have trained through it. So, there are preventive measures like that when you just have, someone watching you and can keep you from making a stupid mistake. Then you have, the physiotherapist just helping. It's just nice because you could get things diagnosed, so you don't have to wonder. Like if you have some kind of pelvic pain, well, that could be 97 different injuries. There are just so many conditions that affect that area. And, but you could just get someone to say, well, here's what it is. And you want to do this to treat it versus that. It's huge, you know, and even the emotional side of, you know, injuries, they're almost like, because if you, like, if you break a bone, that just hurts and you can't use it. But the, you know, overuse injuries, it's not like you're walking around in pain all the time. You just can't run. So the worst of it is actually the not being able to run part. And, you know, there was a woman on the team who was injured when I got there. And it was, you could, you tell it was just hell for her. Like, she's still a member of the team. She's still getting paid. And, but it's like any professional sport, it's what have you done for me lately? So, and she was like, so worried about being able to, the team's contract was going to be up at the end of the year. She wasn't sure if she was going to have a slot, if she couldn't get healthy. It's just a lot, but you know, the runners were very, very good overall in my, from based on what I observed, at just managing the emotional side of injury and just other setbacks as well. I remember Aaron Braun, who was actually the other member of the team who ran the Chicago Marathon. He was dealing with an abdominal hip type of thing. The whole time I was there, he could train, but he was always in pain. And I remember him just bailing out of a run once. It was like, it was a 26 mile run, just this huge, you know, basically marathon length run. And he quit 2 miles from the end. And I thought, well, geez, that's terrible. He's like, no, I'm just being smart. You know, just like it was starting to act up on me. Like a normal, like avid recreational competitive runner, if they got that close to the end of a run that long, they would turn themselves inside out. Even if there was a voice inside their head saying, don't do it, don't do it. It's stupid, why? You've done most, you've gotten most of the benefit. All you can do is like not be able to get out of bed tomorrow if you push it to the end. But you know, these people are young too, you know, but they were making just smart decisions.
Yeah. It sounds like when you stack up lots of really small, intelligent decisions with professional help, it adds to, you know, an overall massive increase from where right. the average person is. It's like not anything particularly special at the time. Hey, I'm just going to cut this one a little bit short, but that added up, you know, over 100 decisions in a week is like a massive, a very different trajectory, you know, over years and years. So what was, you know, so obviously of the groups of the athletes on the team that you ran with, what were their experience levels relatively the same? Like one thing that I've always thought is interesting about running is because in some respects it is like a lower skill sport, it's a lower barrier to entry than say like becoming a professional basketballer. There's like, you know, people can kind of pick it up at different ages and still be extremely successful. And also you can have very long careers in running as well compared to say like NFL, for example. It's a very, get to the top, it's a very short, you know, career length and then you're out. So what were the varying like starting ages if you got into that with the people on the team?
Yeah, most of the people on the team were relatively early starters and in a couple of cases, very early. But so it would range from like Steph Rothstein or Stephanie Bruce, sorry, her married name. She started as a five-year-old, I think, started running and just kept at it. And, you know, she was 32, I think, when I was there, 32, 33, and still getting better. And then the latest starter on the team was Futsum Zainasalasi, who's from Eritrea. It's a refugee, basically, escaped kind of civil war and all that back in.
Ran his way out of there.
Yeah. But he wasn't a runner. He's Eritreans are ethnically pretty much the same as Ethiopians. And of course, Ethiopians have a reputation for being great runners. But he was like more of a soccer guy, but he only started running in high school here in the States and was really damn good at it. So, but you're right. You know, you can pick it up later. This group just happened to be mostly folks who started, you know, middle school, high school type of thing.
Mm.
And what was interesting is that most of the strongest performers on the team were the older runners.
Right.
So it's funny, like it's part of just, I think it speaks partly to Ben Rosario's recruitment and athlete development is that, you know, he wouldn't necessarily recruit the blue chip college runners. Like, you had to be very good. You had to be successful, but they weren't necessarily the national champions. But he saw someone with upside potential, would bring him in. They would be the worst, the slowest runner on the team, maybe the first year or two, but they would just get better and better and better. That was an interesting pattern to observe. Mm.
Yeah, that was sort of my next question is, yeah, how did this particular group come together and get picked? So obviously, yeah, the coach had a huge impact on that and how he's choosing and selecting his runners. How does the team, how does it get funded? I assume it's not government funded. So is it privately funded by a separate organization that owns the team, or is it sponsors? Like, how do they, obviously your situation is completely different, but how do the runners get paid and like how do their contracts work and that sort of thing? I've always been curious.
Yeah, most professional running teams have a single title sponsor, and it's usually a running shoe manufacturer. And that was the case for this team. Sometimes a shoe company will create a team. Other times a team is created and they just find a shoe sponsor. That was the case for Northern Arizona Elite. Ben Rosario is originally from the city of St. Louis, but he moved to Flagstaff to start a professional running team. And he did it on his own savings initially. And so he put a team together, and then he had to find funding. And the natural place to look was, for running shoe companies. So Hoka One One was like a Swiss brand. They were sort of up and coming. The timing was great. So he had, put together something good. They were getting early results. This company needed a team to keep up, the momentum they were building. So that was the primary source of funding. So there was an agent that represents both the team and the athletes individually, because they weren't all paid the same. And they could also have, individual sponsors as well. And some of them did. They just couldn't be another running shoe manufacturer, yeah. But they could have like, a nutrition sponsor or some kind of recovery product or what have you.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, obviously Instagram for any sort of professional, semi-professional, amateur athlete, even depending on the sport, has opened up basically your own channel to make some money to support your athletic endeavors, which is a great thing. I think it's been a really good thing for sport, I think, social media. So when obviously part of there's the physical side of all the training. One thing that, professional athletes have is sports psychologists. Was there a team sports psychologist or mental coach or high performance coach there?
Yes. There was a woman she wasn't full-time with the team because there were only a dozen members. She wouldn't have been busy enough, but Shannon Thompson was affiliated with both the team and with Northern Arizona University, which is the big university in Flagstaff. And she came highly recommended. Again, I was going to do everything. I'm a huge believer in, the impact of the mind on performance. So I was absolutely going to take advantage of that. So, and I write about it in the book. That's one of the things when you're wearing the athlete hat and the writer hat, you have to let people know. It's like anything that happens in this room could end up in a book.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So I think I had four sessions with Shannon, during the time I was there, and she's really good and interesting stuff. Cause it's a kind of shrink, basically. They're getting inside your head and interesting stuff comes out. So I think some of the more entertaining passages in the book have to do with our sessions.
Yeah.
Did it fit into some of the principles you wrote about, in How Bad Do You Want It? Cause in there you had quite a few things on like, hey, this is the best way to approach it, or this, with your mindset seems to work or works for a lot of athletes. Is there carryover into what she does there? Or is it completely different?
Well, Shannon, definitely she has her own angle, for sure. But so much of what she brought to the table, really resonated with me a lot. Epigraph for How Bad Do You Want It? Is that line from Bryce Courtenay's book, The Power of One, The Mind is the Athlete. You know, I'm sure Shannon would say she couldn't agree with that more. So that's one of the things I really liked about working with her is that she understood that the whole person goes into your athletic pursuits. So, you know, and that's why, so she wasn't just teaching me how to do mental rehearsals or whatever. It's like, I don't need that. Right. You know, it was just about, just deeper stuff. Like, you know, I felt, that, you know, part of the reason personal athletic goal or mission there was I wanted to run a better marathon than I'd ever run, at a time much later in life than I thought I would ever have the opportunity. And I had run about 40 marathons by the time I even showed up there. And, you know, I had never just, I felt like hit it out of the park. And one of the reasons I felt was the case, and just this came up through my work with Shannon, was self-sabotage, that in various ways I had been my own worst enemy. And so I didn't want that to happen. And so we talked about how to ensure that it didn't happen. So, you know, kind of deep stuff. Cause I mean, that is you, that's you screwing up something you care a lot about. And, you know, that's, if you can fix that, I think you're fixing more than just a problem that affects marathons or whatever. So it's, yeah, just a, it's a full, it was full-fledged therapy.
Yeah, right. Well, it doesn't surprise me whatsoever. I mean, you're the whole person and, you know, you bring everything into a marathon's enough time to think about, I haven't done it, but I assume it's enough time to think about a lot of things, you know, when your brain's racing at that rate. What was it, you know, obviously, transitioning back out of the experience and, you know, life is very different and stuff, but did you take, what are sort of the main things you now take into your regular training and how you approach life that you got out of that time in the camp?
Yeah, a good question. You know, it's definitely a list of things. One thing for sure was the kind of no stone unturned approach that, you know, when your livelihood depends on how you perform in competition, you don't cut corners. You know, you don't fool yourself that you're doing enough when you might not be. And, you know, I thought of myself as, you know, like, even though I am an amateur athlete, this really is my profession, you know, and, you know, I've created a lifestyle that is conducive to getting after it as an athlete. You know, my wife and I do not have children. I work from home. So I've got all the time I need to train. You know, it's a high priority. I felt like I'm already kind of doing the pro thing, but, you know, I learned otherwise when I got there, that just, you fool yourself. You know, the strength training was a great example. I put the time in, but I was lazy about varying my routine or like keeping fully up to date on innovations, that kind of stuff. Wasn't doing all the mental work. Like my warm-ups were left something to be desired, you know, just, you know, let's get on to the meat of the workout. I don't need all this frilly stuff. But there I had to do the frilly stuff. And guess what? There's a reason they do it. And also just stuff like, you know, reaching out for help. You know, like, you know, I decided my next big goal, I decided after I got home, was to do an Ironman triathlon. I had done one when I was 31, and I wanted to do one at, it ended up being just after my 48th birthday, and I wanted to beat my 31-year-old self at 48. And I took that whole no stone unturned approach into that process and, for example, hired a swim coach. And it was very inconvenient. I had to drive a long ways to get to this coach because she was the closest one who was really good. But I had brought that mentality home with me. I mean, everyone's got to set, if it truly is a hobby, you have to set your own limits on, you know, what is realistic. But, you know, that's what I did. I decided this is worth it. I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to fool myself that I'm doing enough when I'm not.
Mm. And did you beat it? Did you beat your...
I did. I crushed it. Yeah.
Fucking helps.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So it's obviously a... Yeah, it's definitely a unique approach. Like, yeah, I can definitely resonate with what you're saying, leaving no stone unturned when it's everything relies on it. I think that for athletes as well, professional athletes, I should say, is they don't want to show up on game day with any doubt that they've done everything, because that is the stack of confidence that they need to take going into, you know, into the event. And what's interesting as well is that there are so many high-performing, world-class athletes who are the best at what they do, and their version of no stone unturned is so different to someone else's. Like, if I'll give you an example, if you take, like, obviously, like Tiger Woods, for example, when he was at his best, he was like shagging half the golf course, you know, and probably out late drinking and all that stuff. But that was part of what led to his success. That was for him leaving no stone unturned. I mean, look, if you look at it objectively, when he stopped all that stuff, he got a lot worse for a long time. So there's part of that, obviously, that characteristic, that personality profile, that these odd things that are really their version of no stone unturned that add to their success. You know, another example is John Jones in the UFC. He's been the best UFC fighter for a very long time. He's also getting pulled over every second week for a DUI. You know, he's on Instagram and there's a him with, you know, cop body cam footage, and he's like, "Oh shit, officer, I'm drinking again." And he's trying to walk, and it's just like, "Oh, John, again, you know, you hit a pregnant woman and you ran off." But he's still the best in the world. You know, it's just, that's just kind of what they feel like is necessary. You take that away, they do worse, and it's kind of interesting. But no, I can definitely appreciate the no stone unturned. So, Matt, one of the things I want to transition into was, you know, you've got some pretty, even though it seems obvious to someone like us, obviously because we study this stuff, it's quite profound, I think, for the average person to hear. And that's how they should structure their run training to improve at running. It's almost a bit counterintuitive. Can you talk about, like, probably the biggest mistakes that the common runner makes going out for a run, and obviously is initially good, but then plateaus pretty soon?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you were to canvas, you know, 20 experienced running coaches and ask that exactly that question, you would get the same answer from almost all of them, is that the most common and costly training mistake that recreational runners make is doing their easy runs too hard. It's simple as that. I call it the moderate intensity rut. It's kind of like this gray zone or no man's land between easy and hard. It's just really interesting. You know, the research on sort of that proves that this is like a thing and gets into why is interesting. But what you'll find is, like, and these studies have been done, if you just take Joe or Jane person off the street and say, "I want you to hop on this treadmill here and jog for 20 minutes, and you choose your own pace. It's not a race. It's not a test. Just choose a pace." They will choose a pace. 9 out of 10 people you put on that treadmill, randomly selected, will choose a pace that is physiologically moderate. And people are clearly doing it by feel. Like, you know how scientists are. Initially, they're like, "Oh, there must be like some efficiency point that people just find, or like it's a certain percentage of maximum oxygen consumption." Like, all that, not true. But if you ask people to rate their perceived effort, like how it actually feels, they it's on that weird Borg scale from 6 to 20, it's 12.5. Like, that's what everyone does. They hop on the treadmill and they just, like, as if they know, it's like, "I've got to find that 12.5 pace." And they do. So they want it to be kind of hard, but not too hard. And it's fine if you do that one day, but if you do it day after day after day, it's actually when you're never actually running easy, you're never actually fully recovering and or fully absorbing the training you're doing. So you're kind of wasting your time. Like, you're taking, like, you know, 2 or 3 minutes out of every 10 you spend running and lighting them on fire. You know, it's kind of a waste. So even without training more, if you just, and it is counterintuitive, if you just not slow down all the time, but when you actually mean to be running easy, to actually run at a physiologically low intensity, you'll improve.
So what is, I'm sure you got some of your theories behind, why do you think it is that someone drops into that gray zone and they don't just chill, and or they don't push themselves harder or whatever when they should kind of, you know, up the intensity. Maybe they dial it back too much. What are your theories behind it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely more than one reason. In 80-20 triathlon, I enumerate them. There's one chapter where it could be actually kind of demoralizing. Like, here are the 97 reasons you're stuck in this rut. Like, oh God, how do I ever get out? But I think number one is it's really psychological. I think that human beings are naturally task oriented. So if you give us a task, we want to get it done. If I give you an axe and show you a pile of wood that needs to be split, like, you're not going to make it an all day job if it doesn't have to be all day job, especially if I say, when you finish, you can have a beer. So I think it's the same thing with running. You want to get the run over with, and you might not be thinking that consciously, but it's just hardwired into our psychology. The trouble is with running, as we know, the faster you go, the more it sucks. So there's also this other instinct in you that's equally deeply ingrained that wants you to take it easy so that you don't suffer. So when you hop on the treadmill and you're asked to choose, of course, if it's a time-based workout, you can't get it over with quickly. But I think people, you know, we've been around longer than clocks have, so we don't really think about time. We just have that get it done focus. So I think you're balancing these two instincts. Like, I want to get it over with, but I don't want to suffer. And then what happens when you compromise? 12.5.
Right. Yeah. No, definitely. I think a lot of people can relate to that as well. I think the going too easy, I think always just feels like, you said, like a waste of time for people. And I think that maybe for running in particular, because it is so, like, it's one modality. Whereas if it was like, all right, we're going to come and do an easy gym session today, at least you have the novelty of different exercises, different machines, like maybe people in the gym or whatever. You have a bit more stimulus, so you can go a little bit easier. Whereas with running, it's like you're out there on the track and you're like, oh, I can just ramp it up a little bit, you know, and you just have that feeling of like, it's too easy. I'll just ramp it up a little bit. No one ever wants to feel like they didn't work out. I think that's probably the one thing. I'm going to invest this time. Not everyone has all the time in the world to train. While I'm here, I may as well make it count. And they kind of hit that gray zone, like you said.
You also end up fighting the boredom, I think, a lot more as well. Hard enough where it's entertaining in the fact that you can't think about too much else because it's hard, not so hard that it really sucks. But when you go easy, then you almost need something else to entertain yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt,
you know what? 98 reasons people are stuck in moderate intensity run. I hadn't thought of that one, but I think that is valid. Yeah.
Yeah. I think people can do it if you put like Netflix in front. If you're like, hey, you can like go on the treadmill and watch Netflix. Like, okay, I'll run easy here.
Yeah.
But if there's nothing else to do, you're like, nah, I got to get this done.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt, you're familiar with Ross Edgley?
Who?
Ross Edgley.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Well, he's like probably one of the most extreme endurance athletes in the world. I'd say he's probably definitely has the most sort of strange titles next to his marathons. One of them is the triathlon, where he ran a marathon with a tree. And he also recently, his probably biggest achievement was he swam around Great Britain. It took him
6 months.
6 months. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I heard about that. I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. You would have definitely heard about that. Anyway, so he talks about obviously the psychology of what it was like for him, to swim around Great Britain for months and months. And yeah, he did talk about the pacing of, what he had to do, because what was interesting is, you know, you think, okay, I'm just going to hit sort of a moderate zone, like you said, and just slowly chip away at the thing. But he said what he had to do instead, because there's so many different tides that were involved in swimming around Great Britain, depending on the area he was in, is some days he was like, okay, the tide is, or the current is with me at such a pace. It's like, I think you said it's the pace of a dolphin swimming. So he would get in and he would purposely swim extremely easy and just let the current go as hard as possible. There were other days where he's going, the current is in the opposite direction. And so he's like, I have to go in. And he would do 6 hours on, 6 hours off for 6 months. So it didn't matter what time of day it was, whatever. So he's obviously doing night swims. He's obviously doing day swims.
Wow.
Six on, six off. You know, getting in obviously freezing temperatures. He tells multiple stories of him like dusting the ice, the thin layer of ice off his wetsuit before he jumps in. This is, you know, 6 months out on the water. And he would have to get in. And they're like, all right, Ross, it's 6 hours. As like, basically as hard as you can, because you're swimming against the pace of a dolphin, and he would just basically be on a standstill spot, because that's what he had to do for that 6 hour stint, is like not lose as much position as possible. And yeah, if you hear him talk about it, I think the varying intensities of that was like almost a better way to do it in some respects. It's like, okay, just swim easy. Okay, that's my task. Focus on it. Just keep it easy. And I'm still making progress, because it's different, right? They know, they could measure it really clearly. You're making progress here. Whereas a recreational runner might not have that clearer goal. And then it's like, all right, Ross, swim as hard as you can for 6 hours straight. You know, get out of the water. They go, how to do? We go, well, you went approximately negative 17 meters. That's the hardest I swam for 6 hours in my life. And I'm 4 months in. I got 2 months to go. So no, he was pretty impressive there. I recommend his book, Art of Resilience, his new one that he just picked up. It's pretty crazy. But yeah, so sorry, back to the running thing. So in the high intensity piece, how do you find the balance of the low and high intensity? Because obviously a lot of people love high intensity. Almost, like, if you had to tell someone, would you rather go really hard in this or just go super easy? They'd want to go really hard because they feel like they've got a workout out of it. So how do you balance the ratios of hard and easy?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is that most people who are in the moderate intensity rut, they actually never go all that hard either, because you can't, because you're going kind of hard every time. So the second biggest mistake that runners make, number one, is not going easy enough often enough. The other is not going hard enough often enough, because they're really in the middle. So, you know, what the research indicates, and this is what the elites do, is that you should spend about 80% of your total weekly training time at low intensity, 20% at moderate to high. So that second bucket encompasses both moderate and high. And they're two separate zones. And moderate is where most people are most of the time, and they're actually not at high intensity. So you, no matter who you are, you want to obey the 80-20 rule. And it's not like you just explode into a million tiny shards if you're at, you know, 75-25 or, God forbid, 85-15. You know, there's no magic in round numbers. But like that, you know, it should balance out to about that, whereas most people are 50-50. So they're way off. And there's good research showing it's holding folks back. So how you break down that 20%, because again, it encompasses moderate and high, depends. That's where details come in. It's like, well, where are you in your training? What are you preparing for? So, you know, it gets complicated in a hurry. 80-20 is all nice and simple. It's like, oh, that's all there is to it. Well, it's your starting point.
Yeah. And for the high intensity stuff, obviously, I think one thing that we're always most wary of with our clients when we coach them at high intensity is the breakdown of technique and form. So where do you pull back and where do you push in terms of the limits of technique? Because obviously doing a really easy run is a very different technique to kind of pushing maximal intensity. So how do you kind of judge that for your own training and then for people you coach as well?
Yeah, I mean, you never want to run through, or you seldom want to run through extremely high levels of fatigue. And that's true even when you're running at low intensity. You know, there's research showing that, you know, injuries tend to occur most often at the end of long, low intensity runs, because your form breaks down, but you're still on your feet a long time. And, you know, these injuries are not like suddenly rolling your ankle. It's when there's some too much stress accumulating in one, you know, joint or one, you know, area of tissue in your lower extremities. And, you know, it's like Chinese water torture. You do it again and again and again. It adds up. So, you know, if you're running with bad form, it's just as bad to do it at low intensity, and it can break down. So it would be the same for, you know, a high intensity interval workout. You know, of course, fatigue is going to encroach much sooner, much more quickly in that type of workout, but it's the same principle. If you can't hit the same split for the next interval or achieve the same wattage or whatever it is, it's time to hit the shower. So that's just a good principle. You could even not even think about the technique aspect at all and just think about, you know, are you actually benefiting? You know, because, you know, at a certain point, it's no longer training, it's punishment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And well, one thing I sort of missed, I wanted to ask you about was like treadmills. How much treadmill work will then, like, do you think is beneficial? I assume you didn't use too much in your time with the pros, but just in general, how much treadmill stuff do you think is useful for people trying to improve their running times, like on, like not when the test is not on a treadmill?
Yeah, so you know, treadmills, I would say there's a spectrum where, like, I mean, there are some people who just refuse to step on one ever because it's not a tool that anyone actually necessarily needs to use. And there are some people who say, oh, I'd rather just not run at all than run on a treadmill. Okay, fine. There are some people who, you know, they either like it or just circumstances make it, you know, just practical to spend a lot of time in the treadmill. And so then you're, there's no such thing as too little time in the treadmill. There most certainly is such a thing as too much if you're preparing to race outdoors. But, you know, there's an example I like to give. I'm blanking on her name. It's Kristen something or other. But she won the U.S. Olympic Trials Marathon on the women's side in 2000. And she was from Alaska. And she was trained, the trials were held in, I think, like late February or March or something. And so she had to train through the winter in Alaska for the Olympic trials. And so she did almost all of her running on a treadmill, and she won the Olympic trials. So, I mean, clearly it's still running, right? You know, it works. And the funny thing was, she was a dark horse. Like, no one would have picked her. But it was because the trials were held in the South, and it was kind of warm, even though it was, you know, early spring or actually late winter. And so she'd been in a treadmill running in a warm room. So no one else was heat acclimatized. And right. it wasn't like the treadmill was better than running outside, but she was actually prepared for a warm day because she'd been running inside. She probably wouldn't have won under other circumstances.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I think the rise of curved treadmills, I think, is definitely maybe moved more of the, or like the non-motorized treadmills kind of moved more of the running purists over to kind of go, okay, this is a bit more like actual running. I don't know how much experience you've had on them, but they are generally much better to run on than just like a regular treadmill, a motorized treadmill.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one, I own one. It's crazy. I live in California, but I own a treadmill. I actually mostly walk on it. One of my main modes of cross training is steep uphill walks on a treadmill. I use it mostly for that, but it is motorized, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing was like wearables, like fitness technology obviously has come a long way, even since when we last spoke a couple of years ago. You know, one of our partners is Whoop. That's obviously pretty popular in the endurance world. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but even just the technologies inside Garmin's and all sorts of stuff has come a long way. How useful do you find this stuff, and how much were you using it sort of in your endeavors?
Yeah, so, you know, it's one of those things, like a tool can become a crutch. So, you know, I like technology. I'm not like this radical old school Luddite dude who's like, ah, it's all baloney. Like, I'm open to whatever. So, like, if it makes sense conceptually, then it's just a matter of, like, does it work? And then if it works, it's a matter of where's the line between tool and crutch. You know, one of the things I love about running is that when it comes to racing, you know, God strike me down if I'm wrong, but I don't think there will ever be a device that can guide you to optimal pacing to the finish line of a race, because our limits, as I explained in How Bad You Want It, our limits are determined by psychology, not physiology. We never hit our, not in endurance sports, we never touch our physical limits. We can't get there because we hit a hard psychological limit first. And so you have to race by feel in order to race effectively. That will never change. Doesn't mean there isn't that technology can't be used to make you a better runner and even help to some degree with the pacing process. But I like the fact that running is just primal, and you have to, it comes down to you. in the end. But, you know, I'm a fan of, these running power meters, for example, like that, you know, I also ride a bike, so I'm familiar with training by power, but for runners, the power meters came out of nowhere. They're like, what is this? But for me, it was like, it made sense conceptually. Then it was like, well, does it work? And so I've become, even though I was running for decades before running power meters exist, I didn't just dismiss them because they weren't around when I started running. I was open-minded. I think they're great. And I coach athletes who use them, and I'm a fan of that and other technologies as well.
And how do you think like all the leaderboards and like running social media affects everyone? Because one thing I've noticed is very popular around here these days, like Strava and people just comparing their running. But I do think it can get pretty obsessive. People, like, the first thing they do when they finish the run is like upload their score and compare it to everybody else. I would assume, I think it probably worsens the thing you're talking about, like the 50-50, like they end up doing more and more running at moderate because they're probably still not going out, but they don't want to post a really slow run because no one wants to see a really slow run on the leaderboard, right? Do you think that stuff affects it? Or I don't know if it's as big in the States.
Yeah, so that I mentioned my laundry list of things that are keeping people stuck in the moderate intensity rut, and that's one of them. So nice try. You thought you could add another one to my list. I already had that. But yeah, I think it is a factor. You know, it's a frustration for me sometimes as a coach. Every now and then I have an athlete who I'll have them do a workout. And if they're a Strava person, like they're going to do a certain type of workout in a certain place. And then independently, they'll find out that there's King of the Mountain or whatever for that overlaps with the workout I've given them. And then they'll defy the instructions of the workout in order to take down the KOM or whatever it is. So at that point, it's like, who's calling the shots here? Like, I'm not even stepping on my, it's not a matter of like, I've got to control everything, but just, like, keep your eyes on the prize, dude. Yeah. Like, yeah. This isn't what you're training for. Like, this isn't what you need right now. You know, especially with coronavirus, like, I'm now, some athletes, you know, everyone's finding their own ways to stay motivated. So for some people, those are the races now. And I'm totally cool with that. You know, if you want to just, you know, get on top of the leaderboard or climb up the leaderboard, like, and just make it a thing, like a substitute for a race that you can't do. Great. That makes perfect sense. But yeah, when you just lose sight of, like, you know, where you're trying to go. And just because it's just like you're allowing people who shouldn't be allowed to dictate your training to do just that. And it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, if I think back to, you know, say we were doing CrossFit training or any type of training, you would never post all your scores from any workout so everyone could read it. That would, like, everyone know that's stupid. You're like, oh, you just, like, share that between your coach and yourself and, like, your training partner. And not everyone else needs to know that. Whereas I do think there's, like, some negative aspect to just automatically sharing every single workout you do with the general public and your peers, really.
Yeah. You know, for me, like, I'm on Strava, but all this stuff is mostly just marketing for me. Like, I just, it's a way to get more people to find out that I write. But so, like, you know, I just share or whatever. And I just don't care. I don't even look at, like, leaderboards and stuff. But I do see how people get sucked in, because there's one, like, last spring, I did a cross country trip, and my wife's father lives in Oklahoma in the middle of the country. And we stopped there for, I think, one night, and I went for a run in his neighborhood the next morning. And so months pass, almost a year passes, and someone who follows me on Twitter, no, someone who lives in that same neighborhood is a runner, did a run the same place I did one, and then discovered that I had the top score for that route. And he knew who I was, you know, from my books. And so he made it a mission. Like, he's not nearly as fast a runner as I am, but he made it. But I was just jogging, you know, I was on a cross country trip. I just went out to, you know, scratch the itch. And so the guy takes down my my mark for that run and then crows about it on Strava. I'm like, oh no, you didn't. Like, I have half a mind to drive back out there right now and put that segment out of reach forever.
Okay, that's good. That is good. I like that. That is good. And plays on our natural competitive instincts.
Yeah, it does.
Very much so. Cool. So, Matt, we wrap all the shows with four questions. You answered them last time. We probably got different answers this time. So, first question, Matt, is if you could sit down and interview anyone that is alive today, who are you speaking to and why?
Yeah, you know, the answer, I'm going to give you a topical one. Do you know who Colin Kaepernick is?
He took the NFL player who took the knee.
Right. He's actually, he played his high school ball. I live kind of in nowhere, California. It's not all beaches in California. Like, I'm out in the country, but he grew up very close to where I live. I don't want to get political or anything. Well, I'm about to, but I supported his protest from the beginning. I thought it was cool and brave. And now he's having this kind of weird vindication. Like, he sacrificed everything. And he's clearly, it was out of principle. Like, he had nothing to gain and everything to lose. So now that it's kind of come full circle in a way, or half a circle, whatever, things have changed. I would love to sit down with him and just pick his brain, because, you know, I admire courage. People who just, have principles and they're willing to pay a cost in defense of those principles. So I would just like to pick his brain about, did you have any regrets? Was it, because he makes it, when he's interviewed about it, he makes it seem like, oh, this was, I had my mind made up. I didn't care what I had to sacrifice. But I wonder if he had like his moments of crisis of confidence, or, is this worth it? Or if he was fearful, at any point, like, to, just get inside the head of someone who has that kind of courage.
Mm. So has he got, you're saying he's gone back on his stance? Is that
no? Reason? No, I'm not. I'm saying, no. I'm wondering if he was ever tempted to,
right?
Or if he just, if he had moments of doubt. I mean, it's a hard thing, and it's so hard that no one else did it. Yeah. I mean, he was first, but maybe it wasn't so easy. I mean, like, he makes it. He just did it, right? And he showed no sign of going back. But I just wonder, how hard was it? And like, did you go back and forth? Did you waver? That kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think for people that don't know, he basically destroyed his career making the stances. Like, he would have had he would have had a much better NFL career.
Is he
much
done longer. Now?
Yeah, well, like, no team would really wanted him.
Yeah.
I guess he's just... he's a bit of a pest if you're just like a white NFL team owner, and there's plenty of other players you can get,
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cutthroat business. But he got a really big deal with Nike. I know he got like his own shoe and stuff. So I think he made some money out of it. But yeah, he obviously lost everything worked for.
Yeah. I mean, it's a once in a lifetime career. I'm sure he would have dreamed about his whole life. So much hard work would have gone into it. So it is pretty amazing to kind of risk the whole thing and ultimately probably destroy it.
Right. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah,
it's great. One of the expressions, I need to make a list of like truisms that aren't true. And one that's near the top of my list is everyone has their price. No, they don't. Most people have a price, but a few don't. And those are the people I want to sit down with and pick their brains to get back to your question.
Yeah, no, especially people that already really have a lot of money. It's like them to do something. There is no cost. There's no amount of money they can help them or get them to do what you want. So second question, Matt, is there anything that you try and do every single day? I think last time your answer was running, but maybe something separate that you feel like is essential to the success of your day.
Yeah, you know what? I almost went with running again, but then I realized it's breakfast, for crying out loud. Like, that's the first thing I do every day. Like, I'm someone, I wake up hungry, and it's one reason I don't run first thing in the morning. I know a lot of people do. And I will only do it like when I'm doing like a depletion run, where you go out and run, 30K or whatever on an empty stomach, and you don't take in any carbs, and like, that's a thing, but I dread it, because like, I just want to eat. But it really does. I mean, there's a reason I wake up and eat. Even if I'm not hungry, I wake up. It just sets me up. I'm a man of routine, top to bottom. But yeah, that's if I had to give up every other routine and could only keep one, I think it would be breakfast.
I'm curious, what is your staple breakfast?
My staple, my go-to, well, that's a routine as well. It's like this, whole grain, low sugar granola with whole milk, organic whole milk, and fresh berries, whatever is in season. Black coffee, strong black coffee. I mix it up a little bit, but that's my go-to.
Yeah,
I grew up eating breakfast cereal like so many people, but then I realized this is candy.
It's the worst possible thing.
So, but the thing is, as a person who writes about nutrition and actually has a certification for sports nutrition, part of my philosophy is tweak, don't overhaul. Unless your diet is just garbage and you do need to start over, I think people should actually change as little as necessary to get the results they want. And so I almost do it as a statement to eat that breakfast, because it's okay. You can eat things that are familiar, that are part of your culture, that are comforting. Just raise the bar, just eat a healthy version. That's my version of kneeling for the national anthem. I'd be willing to go to jail for my granola.
It's actually speaking of, taking what is obviously a massive cultural staple in definitely in American culture, cereal. There's this company, Magic Spoon. I don't know if you've heard of them. I sincerely hoped and sincerely wish that they do come to Australia at some point, bring their product. But they're basically like a high protein cereal, but they taste and every attempt at a high protein cereal in the past has been just a complete disaster, or tasted like absolute rubbish. But their combination is incredible. Apparently it just tastes like the sweetest, most delicious. There's all kinds of blueberry muffin and salted caramel popcorn and all those sorts of flavors. But if the ingredients is, there's no sugar in it whatsoever. It's all natural, all whole food natural ingredients. And it's high protein, which is basically been impossible to pull off before in a cereal that these guys did. I almost feel like they're the Quest bar of the cereal industry, because obviously Quest made a protein bar that had never been done before. I don't know if you know much about the Quest story, but when they said, he said, I want the bar to contain these ingredients and have these macronutrients, they were no, that's not possible. We just don't do it. There's no machine on earth that can build that for you. And he goes, cool, I'll build my own machine. And they built their own machines to manufacture that process, to revolutionize that bar. And sounds like that's what's been done with Magic Spoon. When we take our next trip to the States, whenever that is, probably in 10 years, at this rate, we'll probably bring back so much Magic Spoon. We'll be almost in Australia. No, that's good. So Matt's third question is, what is something recently that you have changed your mind on that for a while you held as a strong belief?
Yeah, it's embarrassing to change your mind. When you put something, a belief in a book, and then it's there's this permanent record. It's not just, telling your wife, you were right. I hate it, but I also I wouldn't want to just, that there's that Emerson quote, foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. So I want to be willing to, because then I'd rather be right than consistent, So I've changed my mind about a lot of things. Recently, I'm toying with changing my mind about the optimal way to pace marathons. The prevailing opinion is that you should just lock in, assuming it's flat. You have a goal pace that you've thought about that is, is right. You just lock into it and hold it. I'm reading this book right now by a well-known French exercise physiologist, Véronique Bellat. And she challenges that idea. And so I've just read the book. It's actually a pre-publication. It's available in French, but she, she knows her stuff. She makes a pretty compelling argument. I will say there's stuff in the book that I just disagree with, and she's not going to change my mind. So I could end up deciding she's wrong about this, but I think it shows a little bit about my process is that I do, you know, I have my beliefs, but I try to be receptive to challenges to them. And so I've been guinea pigging her. I read the book. I've been guinea pigging some of her methods, and I'm open, you know, to coming away basically agreeing with her on that piece. So that could be next. I could come to you a year from now, whenever you have me back on the show, and say, you know what, steady pacing for the marathon is out.
Yeah. So is it front loading or back loading?
It's both. So she talks about like a U-shaped pacing strategy where you kind of you start out like a bat out of hell, and then you ease back to actually a pace that's slower than your goal pace, not by a ton, but by a little. And I exaggerated about the bat out of hell thing. Like, you know, you start faster than your goal pace, settle into something that's slower, but then you and then you finish fast too. But in that middle part, when it is slower, you're oscillating. And so I tested this in a half marathon distance marathon pace run just 2 days ago. And it was a disaster, actually.
I thought you were going to say, I crushed it. Like,
no, I mean, because I've been spending a lifetime training myself to lock into it. So even if she's right, or even if like there's a way that it can work for me, it probably wasn't going to work the first time. So I'm not sure I'm going to hold on to that starting fast thing, but I do like, she believes in letting your pace, perceived effort actually allow your pace to fluctuate. And I think she's absolutely right about that, is that if you lock in too much, and like, this is one of the problems with turning a device into a crutch, is that like, really, your brain doesn't want to do that. Even if you're on a flat course and you overall are trying to keep it steady, you know, there should be stochastic variations that are really based on just kind of, if you lock into a steady pace, you're not going to feel the same at that pace. So it's like you choose, you want to have a steady perception of effort or a steady pace, because you actually can't really have both. And I'm pretty convinced she's right about that, that you should oscillate based on how you're feeling, as long as it's not, you know, wild.
Mm. Yeah, nice. No, that's good. Mm. Wait, so just to clarify, did you read that in French?
No. No, it's so it's bad. Yeah, that would be. I'm.
I love me.
Like, maybe that's why you got some weird ideas. This is bad translation.
No, I do not read French, so it's being translated into English, and so I have a pre-publication copy of the English translation. Yeah,
makes sense. Okay, and then final question, Matt. Do you have a favorite quote of yours? I know you just shared one, which was pretty good. I thought you were going to say the quote. That I don't know who said it, but it was like, I'd rather be a hypocrite than stay the same. I don't know who said that, but it's along the similar lines. But do you have a favorite quote, and do you also have like a book that you would recommend? Obviously, you just did two of those, but is there some other ones you prepared?
I think that was Adam Yauch from the Beastie Boys who said that.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, sick. Yeah, perfect. Maybe, I can't remember where I heard it, but maybe.
I heard him say exactly that. I mean, he's passed away, but the Beastie Boys did this kind of retrospective show recently, and they showed a clip of him saying exactly those words. But yeah, maybe he was quoting someone else.
That's right. We'll take it. Beastie Boys quote on the My Muscle Project. first time. But yeah, a book or a quote that you'd recommend for the listeners?
Yeah, this one's out of left field, but you know, so the writer or thinker who's had kind of had the biggest impact on just the way I think is the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. And I know like he's controversial and I don't agree with everything he wrote, but you know, I was introduced to his work at an impressionable age. You know, I was think 19 or something. And I think the first book of his I read was The Genealogy of Morals. The thing I struggle with all the time in the work I do is inside the box thinking. And we're all guilty to it. We're all prone to getting stuck inside the box without realizing there's even a box, right? Yeah, that's a bit tricky. And And Nietzsche, he was just like sort of a Socratic type of skeptic. Like, it's not that hard to do to be a skeptic and teach yourself to think outside the box. What you do is like anytime you're presented with an idea, you assume it's false. That's all you do. And it's a little harder if it's an idea that you've been exposed to your entire life, so you don't even realize that it's contingent, you know, that it's an idea that didn't always exist. But it's a great exercise to do. It's just like, assume it's false. Like, pretend you have to defend the contrary viewpoint, even if it's your own conviction. And often you at least if you don't change your mind, you come up with a more nuanced understanding of your own position. And it was just, you know, a lot of philosophy is impenetrable, but Nietzsche, and no, I did not read him in German, though at one point I could have actually, believe it or not. But he, you know, he's a really engaging writer. He actually had a big influence on my writing as well. Not that I write anywhere nearly as well, but he has like a punchy kind of muscular writing style, and it doesn't read like philosophy at all. So it's something that can just sort of teach you to, it can enhance your critical thinking skills just to expose yourself to his way of thinking. And they're just super readable. Almost every line from any book could be a bumper sticker. It's great stuff.
Yeah, right. That sounds good. Awesome, Matt. Well, you've obviously got a lot of your own books, and you know, we'll say it first that we love reading your work and your writing. You're a fantastic writer. And anyone that like is like, oh, I'm not a reader, you know, I struggle to read. Like, your books aren't like reading. It's just like one long story. So I think that's why they're so engaging. So we talked about a few books today. But Matt, what's the best place where people can find all your work?
My personal website is mattfitzgerald.org. There is a books tab on there, and I think it's got them all. There's too many. Don't scroll down too far. I just prefer that some of those remain lost to history.
Don't buy the old shit.
They're out of publication. And you also do coaching as well. One of my good friends has been getting coaching off you, man, I want to say over a year now. And he has some ridiculous running times, and he's definitely completely changed. And he was already a super fit guy. And he's already changed the way that he approaches his ideas about running, his beliefs about running and how programming should be. And he's been running injury free, which was a big thing for him as well. And smashing time. So you offer coaching as well.
Right on. Thanks for the plug.
All right. Matt, thanks so much for being on again. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Guys, an amazing episode with Matt. Remember, you can pick up any of his books on Audible. They're a great listen. That's kind of how I prefer to absorb his work, because there's so much storytelling in there. Or you can obviously just purchase the books as well from the places that he mentioned. Guys, remember, we are doing a strength training program now. We have launched the first project program, Project Strong. If you are looking to get super strong, if you're a bit bored with your program, if you're feeling a bit weak, or you're just kind of writing your own thing and you're sick of writing it yourself, now's the time to jump on board. It's super affordable. It's about 30% of the cost of your monthly phone bill. If you go to themindmuscleproject.com/strong, you can pick up a 7-day free trial for the program. And we also have a 30-day money back guarantee. So if you're doing it, you're like, you know, this program sucks, I want my money back, it is all yours. You can take it back. So completely risk-free for you guys, and obviously the 7-day free trial. As well, we talked about at the start of the episode, the Whoop band. Make sure you guys jump on board, whoop.com, mind muscle, one word. Use that as a code when you check out. That's mind muscle when you order your Whoop 3.0 strap. That's going to save you 15% off your entire cart. And then they've got tons of new different bands, and they've even got aqua bands now if you swim a lot with your band. So all kinds of cool stuff you can add to your cart. And then as well, guys, another amazing company, Activated Nutrients. If you want a whole food vitamin and minerals, greens powder product to have on a daily basis to improve your immunity and just overall well-being, activatednutrients.com, offer MMP, one word, saves you 20% off. That's offer MMP, one word, when you check out for 20% off. Guys, thank you so much, and we'll speak to you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.